Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we'll hear from a scholar who's examining the connections between the legal mechanisms and surveillance created in the early years of our country to protect slave owners and slavery, to the struggles over policing and violence against African Americans today. My guest is a historian specializing in the history of American slavery and the issues that surround this dark period of American history. Edward Baptist is the House Dean of the Carl Becker House and a professor of history at Cornell University. His most recent book, released in 2014, The Half Has Never Been Told, is an acclaimed study that analyzes slavery and its influence on the development of American capitalism and the beginnings of the Industrial Age. His latest project is titled Freedom on the Move, a crowdsource analysis of nearly 200,000 runaway slave ads published throughout the 17th and 18th century in American newspapers, and its effect on the slaves, their families, as well as forging a common identity for whites. And that's the subject for his lecture Monday evening as the 2017 Caden Head Settle Lecturer in History. The lecture takes place this coming Monday at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center on the TU campus and is free and open to the public. And he joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Edward Baptist, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
In your last book, The Half That Has Never Been Told, in 1850 you said there were 3.2 million enslaved people in the United States, and they had a market value of about $1.3 billion, and that was about a fifth of the nation's wealth, almost equal to the nation's GNP at the time. So your last book documented the economic and industrial growth that slavery fueled during the 19th century. This next book talks about what happened to the actual people. This next project you're on is actually talking about what happened to those people. It's called Freedom on the Move. What are you researching now?
Well, the Freedom on the Move project, which I'm actually working on collaboratively with a couple of other professors, Molly Mitchell at University of New Orleans and Josh Rothman at University of Alabama, along with other scholars and students and computer support folks and so on, is an attempt to document and present the so-called runaway slave ads, which were placed by enslavers when somebody tried to run away, tried to get away. And these are all over the newspapers of the pre-Civil War United States. They actually continue right up to the end of slavery, at the end of the Civil War, in fact. And they document a lot of personal details about people whose personal details have, in many cases, been lost or even sort of deliberately excluded from the historical record. These are things that may be as sort of mundane as the height of a man or woman who's trying to escape, but may also be more detailed. I think he's going to try to get to Mobile, where his mother lives, or she can read and write, and she's probably going to try to fake a pass, you know, a document that would let her pass through the sort of scrutiny of law enforcement officials. So what these do is, and I think there are about 100,000 to 200,000 of these ads, these give us some new windows into the experience of slavery, and especially the experience of resistance to slavery.
And one of the things you did in that last book, The Half That Has Never Been Told, you told some stories that are recounted in history and others through oral histories. Of one person in particular, Charles Ball, which this is a slave in, I believe, Maryland in right around the first decade of the 19th century.
That's right.
Who is, one day, he's attending church, and he comes out from church, and he sees his master talking to another person, and irons are clapped on him. He has a family in Maryland. And he shipped off to South Carolina, a 450-mile march over what passed for roads in those days. Is this sort of the next side of Charles Ball and others like him, who this forced migration that you write about in The Half That Has Never Been Told? A million people moved from the Upper South to the Cotton Belt during the five decades of slavery in the 19th century.
Yeah. So in Charles Ball's case, he escapes, and then he escapes again because the first time he's able to make his way back to his family in Maryland, his wife is actually legally free. She's a former slave, and she and he eventually move across the state line into Pennsylvania because it feels safer for him and his family. But then as he grows older, somebody basically drops a dime on him and lets the authorities know, here's a guy who probably escaped from somewhere in the Deep South. And there's a whole network of slave hunters the line between slave hunting, law enforcement, and slave trading is pretty blurry in a lot of the U.S. in that period of time. And so he's seized about 20 years after he's initially escaped. He's taken back down to Georgia, where his former owner's heir now lives. And he makes his way to freedom again. He escapes. He travels down to Savannah and stows away on a cotton ship. But when he goes back to Pennsylvania, his family is gone. They vanished. Probably had been kidnapped into slavery under the claim that, you know, they were actually legally slaves. So he tells his story to an abolitionist in the Philadelphia, New York area, and then he makes his way out of the U.S. We don't know what happens to him after that. We don't have a whole lot of details on him. But that side of the story, that side that Charles Ball exemplifies, that resistance to enslavement and oppression is something that plays a role in The Half Has Never Been Told, but I wanted to highlight it more in the next book, and I think it's actually something that's very useful to all people to understand and to read about in tough times.
You sort of relate in the last book about how terror, torture was used as a motivating tool, which even today some people don't want to hear about slavery, which I find amazing. That what was the productivity increase in cotton production, not due to the cotton gin or easier to pick, but you said it was due to violence and the threat of violence against slaves. It was like a fivefold increase in productivity in the cotton belt.
Yeah, over time, between about 1800 and 1860, enslaved people seemed to pick about four times as much per day. I mean, that's the change. And of course, we don't precisely know how much of that is due to terror and how much is not, but certainly slave owners believe that terror is a very effective motivator, and they have a very extensive system for encouraging people to pick more and letting them know that if they don't pick up to their quotas, they're going to be whipped. They're going to be brutally beaten. One thing that I think is interesting is that in U.S. history, even among professional historians, we have a sort of code under which we don't call whipping what it was. You know, we might call it whipping, but we might also call it discipline, right, which is a word right out of the master's playbook. What we don't do is call it torture, and I think that, you know, if this was inflicted on a member of our own family by, you know, somebody who's got some sort of claim to authority, we would call it torture. That's what we would call it, no matter who did it. In fact, we would call it torture because it is brutal punishment, brutal assault that is intended to force people to reveal something, in this case, how much they can pick if they go at full speed all day long, something that they don't want to do, right? Something that they don't want to reveal. So we call whipping under slavery, we call this torture by all kinds of euphemistic names, which I think gets back to that point you made about our reluctance to actually talk about the history of slavery in honest and open terms in this country.
Now, it sounds like you're focusing not only on the resistance, but also on the sort of industry that depended on that resistance and flight. Is that also a focus today?
Yeah, in the new project, that's certainly a focus, and we could make the claim, and one of the things I want to do with the new project is sort of test this claim, but we can make the claim that a lot of the origins of law, policing, and incarceration in the United States run back into this attempt to keep enslaved people in place, to force them to stay where they are, to work for whoever, you know, legally holds title to them. And this creates this creates a system of law, a set of laws about runaways, a system of interstate compacts. Once you have some states that are free under the Constitution, they are bound to return runaway slaves. And so returning runaway slaves becomes one of the sort of bargains that holds the Union together. And when some states push back against it, creates some stresses in the Union. And so at every level of government, from the local law enforcement, the constables, the slave patrols, and so on, to the judges and the legislators who create the structures of law and institutions that capture people, hold them, send them back to their owner, all the way to the national level, government is involved in the policing of enslaved people's movement and the surveillance of enslaved people's movement and catching runaways and sending them back. And that's to a large extent, it's not the entire story of the origin of police, law enforcement, and incarceration in the U.S., but it's part of the story.
This also didn't disappear with the Civil War, did it?
That's right. It certainly didn't. Certainly didn't in the South, where law enforcement and incarceration takes the form of a kind of neo-slavery. The seizing of people for almost any pretext, putting them on chain gangs or leasing them out as convict laborers, sending them, in the case of Texas, to massive cotton and sugarcane growing farms, where you actually see the persistence of the system of cotton picking, where you have to pick so many pounds a day or be whipped. So particularly in the South, we see that continue. In the North and in the other states that by 1860 had been free states after the Civil War, you see what you already saw, which is a large number of disproportionate number of African Americans coming under the radar, the gaze, or whatever of the police, being seen as suspicious, being locked up, sometimes for actually committing crimes, and sometimes for nothing in particular. And that's also part of the story of incarceration in the U.S. This question of whether or not it's going to be for rehabilitation or whether it's going to be for containment of populations that the majority sees as sort of inherently suspect.
I was actually thinking of, say, in the early 20th century when you had this great migration to the North, you either had law enforcement or private law enforcement trying to keep African Americans from moving north, from being that cheap source of labor in the South.
That's right. And there's resistance to black movement in both the North and the South. There's local law enforcement and locally powerful landowners who try to keep people down on the farm, as it were, in the South. And then in the North, and this is different city to city and community to community, but in many cases there's a great anxiety about the migration northward. And we focus on things like the rise of the second Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s, which is as much a northern and midwestern phenomenon as anything else. But also part of the story is what happens in the court, the prison, and the police systems to first deter African Americans from moving into the communities. And in some cases, we see the development of so-called sundown towns, mm-hmm. Where people are literally forbidden from staying in communities or are forced out of them. And in other cases, we see it through the sort of containment of people of color, especially African Americans, in specific geographic segregated neighborhoods.
My guest today is Edward Baptist, a professor of history at Cornell University. His most recent book was in 2014, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. It was a major book when it came out, and he's currently working on this interactive project with a number of scholars titled Freedom on the Move, which is looking at the whole system of resistance and escape from slavery, as well as the industry that sort of was out to capture those escaped people and take them back to slavery. He'll be giving the 2017 Cadenhead Settle Lecture in History Monday evening at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, what are you learning so far from, I know this, you've got crowdsourcing involved with putting these advertisements about escaped slaves on the web and as a research tool. What are you learning so far?
One thing we're learning is that these are great, these runaway slave ads are great teaching tools, and 10 different people can look at them and they'll write down the same words and they'll get the gist, but they'll also notice details that maybe I might not if I looked at it one time, and they'll sort of call those out if we assign a group of students to look at some of these ads and transcribe them and so on. They'll point out things that we wouldn't necessarily notice on our own just because it's more sets of eyes. Another thing we're noticing is that the runaway ads, they hit a kind of sweet spot, if you will, because they show the really horrific nature of slavery in the United States and the toll that it took on people's bodies and families and so on. You know, you see the attempts to return to family. You see desperately risky gambles that people are making to try to get away. You read, because there's lots of identifying detail, you read about scars and people with severed fingers and bits of ears chopped off, and you don't necessarily know where that comes from, but you know that some of those come from assaults that are inflicted on enslaved people. But, of course, you also see the resistance, as you said. And so it's a great balance for students. You know, they get to understand both sides, both the exploitation and the violence of the system, which is undeniable in the ads, but also that enslaved people resisted, and that this resistance was incredibly risky, and yet people kept doing it. They kept trying it. They kept putting pressure on the system. And I would argue that's ultimately, one way or another, that's ultimately what brings about the Civil War. And that's what brings down the system of slavery.
In what ways?
Well, people like Charles Ball put pressure on the system by coming to the North. And in fact, some of the impetus even for emancipation in the northern states, which, you know, are their slave states in 1776, right? All of them.
Right.
And they gradually move towards emancipation. But in many cases, say in Massachusetts, for instance, a lot of the pressure for freedom comes from people who run away from slavery, and then they find people to help them push lawsuits or other kinds of measures against the state law, challenges to the state law, that then encourage those states to go ahead and create emancipation laws. So once those states become free, they become a kind of base in which people who successfully escape slavery can create communities as long as they are not recaptured by bounty hunters and law enforcement officials. And those communities are, without question, the most crucial pillars for the abolitionist movement in the United States. That's no disparagement of the white abolitionists who, in many cases, like William Lloyd Garrison, risked life and reputation many times. But the real base is in black communities in the North. That's not just where the support, but that's where the key ideas in the abolitionist movement, in my point of view anyway, come from.
And
so
it's really
pressure on the system.
Yeah, and really interesting that history books tell us about the white abolitionists more.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a lot of great scholarship recently that takes a far more balanced view, and even going further back, African-American historians and other scholars were certainly making this point as well. Oklahoma's own John Hope Franklin certainly was at the forefront of that. But there's been some great scholarship recently that insists that ultimately this is a black movement in which white allies played a very important role. But it the movement continually through public pressure and through the continued escapes of enslaved people creates a kind of trickle of water that eats away at the dam, if you will, drives a wedge between the North and the South on these issues, makes it hard for Northern politicians to continually please both their own constituents who are being agitated by the abolitionist movement and their Southern allies in either the Whig or the Democratic Party. As time goes on, the pressure can't be sustained, and the South begins to pull away and to argue that slavery will not be safe from the continued pressure of runaways and abolitionists unless they can create their own independent slaveholding republic.
What becomes apparent, though, from your last book was that this was not a completely monolithic movement in the North. As you write about how slavery really built American capitalism, you know, the North was benefiting tremendously economically from Southern slavery.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the first factory industry that develops in the North, as really in the Western world as a whole, the first thing we would recognize as a modern industrial factory system is the cotton textile mill, and that depends on cheap and ever cheaper raw cotton, which, of course, you know, the faster and faster, more and more productive cotton picking in the South is generating cheaper and cheaper raw materials for those mills. And from those mills develops a whole series of spin-off industries, new consumer markets, and so on and so forth. So slavery is crucial in that way. It's also crucial financially, and that it it provides a vehicle for investment. It encourages the development of a deeper and deeper and more complex financial sector in the United States. It encourages other countries to invest in the U.S., whether they're investing directly or indirectly in the southern states, because the South is moving so much cotton into the world economy. It shouldn't be surprising that, that there's a great deal of investment, both directly in the movement of that cotton and indirectly in the sector that is generating the cotton, which is enslaved people.
Yeah, I was surprised to know that the enslaved people were actually assets, and they were used that way in accounting and in finance,
right.
Financing bonds.
Right,
with the slaves as collateral.
Right.
And those were instruments that were not only created just for the Southern planters, they were bought by investors literally throughout Europe and in the United States.
That's right. The bonds that finance a lot of the Southern banks are very clearly backed ultimately by mortgages on enslaved people and on the land that they cultivate, but especially on enslaved people. So that's very important to the financial development of the United States. And a lot of the financial houses that survive have direct or indirect connections right back to that time. One of them that didn't survive was Lehman Brothers, which got its start as a cotton brokerage house in Mobile in the 1840s. But there are many other connections as well, some of which have been documented by activists pressing reparations lawsuits and things like that, and some of which are known to historians, but perhaps haven't reached the general public yet.
One of the big themes of the half has never been told is the forced migration issue. Nearly a million slaves moved from the Upper South to the Cotton Belt in Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, Georgia, and the like. One of the things I was really struck by looking at some of the graphs in the book was you have Virginia and Maryland is where most of those slaves came from. You have so many slaves there, but yet it's not a cotton producer. Was it tobacco, or were they actually producing slaves as a product themselves?
Yeah, by the 19th century, it's hard to tell. Tobacco is of course, the crop that makes the Virginia and Maryland colonies successful and helps to pay for a great deal of the English crown's bills in the late 1600s, in fact. And that's what drives the importation of enslaved people from Africa to Virginia and to Maryland in the late 17th and early 18th century. But by the early 19th century, those tobacco producers have a lot of competition from Kentucky, from North Carolina, from other colonies and other countries around the world. And the market for tobacco has more or less stagnated. But the market for slaves, because of the great explosion in international demand, which is driven by the Industrial Revolution for cotton. I mean, that market for slaves in Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana, Texas, Florida, Georgia, et cetera, that is just booming and booming. So, you know, I think one way to think about this is something I didn't talk about maybe as much as I could have in that book, is to understand that what's happening in the slave trade is not just a shift of human beings so that their productive labor can be exploited. What's also happening is an exploitation of the reproductive labor of families in Virginia and North Carolina and Maryland and so on. So not just that mothers are bearing children and raising them and so on, but that entire households, as we humans do, entire households are devoted to raising their children out of love and social convention and everything, right? This is what we do as human beings. And all of that work is being turned into profit for the slave owner who sells the enslaved 12 or 14 or 15-year-old to the slave trader who's going to turn a profit, and then ultimately to the slave owner in Mississippi who's going to enjoy the prime years of labor of that individual.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's the timeline on writing a book on freedom on the move? Are you still gathering evidence now, or what's exactly going on with that?
Yeah, I am very much in the research phase. I'm doing some writing, and in particular on the early era, and that's what I'm going to try to talk about, is the development of law and the development of culture around this idea of policing black movement, which I think develops pretty early in the colonies. In fact, that's part of how the basic law of slavery, slavery and race, gets defined in the U.S. But as I said, it goes beyond statute law and into customs and so on as well. So I'm still pretty early, but I'm going to try to give a few early returns when I talk on Monday, and hopefully I'll get some good feedback, good questions, which will hopefully spur this project to get better and better.
One of the things that's become evident with your last book and probably even with this project is this is still a subject that we Americans do not want to talk about in a openly honest way. I have to leave with the Economist's review of The Half Has Never Been Told. And as you well know, this phrase, Mr. Baptist has not written an objective history of slavery. Almost all the blacks in his books are victims. Almost all the whites are villains. To me, that seems like a very telling statement that sort of informs race in America even today, even though it was written probably by a British reviewer.
Yeah. Well, those reviews are anonymous. Yeah, I was saddened to read that. I really was, and it was really unfortunate. But I think in this country, it's tough for us to formulate identities that, particularly if we are obviously of European descent mostly, or obviously of African descent mostly. I think it's tough to formulate identities that are not shaped primarily, or to a large extent, let's put it that way, by our difficulty in dealing with slavery in this country. And I'm not talking about what people think about on the inside, but you know, I'm talking about how we tend to react when subjects like this come up. It's and in particular, let me talk about whites. You know, I think it's just too easy for whites in this country to retreat to the position that, oh, you're blaming me for something my ancestors did. No, we're trying to actually take a look at what happened in the past and come up with a clear and useful understanding of how it shapes the present. And it's only when we can do that unflinchingly, and when we can really honestly measure the sort of wages of that, the privilege, as well as the monetary wealth that accrues to those of us who are white in this country, that we're really going to be able to have honest conversations in this country about slavery. And I think I argue in the book that enslaved people had honest conversations about slavery. Formerly enslaved people had honest conversations about slavery. African-American historians have had honest conversations about slavery. And I think it's incumbent on the rest of us to join that honest conversation about slavery.
All right. Well, we look forward to your talk on Monday night. Edward Baptist, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Edward Baptist is a professor of history at Cornell University and the author of the 2014 book, The Half Has Never Been Told. He'll be this year's 2017 Cadenhead Settle Lecturer in History, speaking about his latest project, Freedom on the Move. The lecture titled Creating White Freedom by Hunting Enslaved Africans takes place Monday evening, February 6th at 7 o'clock in the Lorton Performance Center and is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.